been arrested for allegedly trying to sell that same Senate seat. Democrats backed Burris rather than risk losing the seat to Republicans in a special election. But a federal appeals court has ruled the 17th Amendment requires Senate vacancies to be filled by election, that appointments are only temporary. That forced current Illinois Governor Pat Quinn to call for a special election. It will be held November 2nd, the same day as the general election, which means whoever wins will serve only the last few weeks of Mr. Obama's Senate term. For NPR News, I'm Robert Wildebohr in Chicago.
The Commerce Department has a much better picture about the recession. Apparently, it was worse than we thought. In revisions issued today, the government believes the economy shrank 2.6% last year, not 2.4% as previously thought. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we add one more tribute to Daniel Shore, who continued to be an NPR news analyst until a few weeks before his death last week. We'll listen back to the interview we recorded in 1994 on the 20th anniversary of Nixon's resignation. We talked about Shore's CBS coverage of Watergate and his run-ins with CBS and the Nixon administration. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, our producer, and at the controls, Henry Frayne. Today, we can choose from a wide range of devices, most of them portable and a lot of them even pocket size, that can give us instant access to an enormous amount of information. And we know that there are people who spend many hours a day using these things and immersing themselves in this vast ocean of information. We also know that the internet has changed the world, no doubt about it. But the question that we want to explore this morning is this. Has the internet changed us as well, in a fundamental kind of a way? And our guest for the program is Nicholas Carr, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And it is published by W.W. Norton. And in this book, he makes the argument that while we might not yet understand the full extent of the effect, that new media have indeed begun to change us and change the way our brains develop and function, and not necessarily for the better. He has certainly helped to accelerate a kind of conversation about these issues, and he really, in part, helped to get that going a couple of years ago when he wrote an essay that was published in the Atlantic Monthly. The title is Google Making Us Stupid. This was in summer of 2008, and it certainly got a lot of people talking, and some of the ideas that you find in The Shallows takes that and has moved it forward and developed it even further. So certainly if you're interested in the subject, you want to take a look at this book that we'll be talking about this morning. Our guest, Nicholas Carr, writes on the social, economic, and business implications of technology. He's the author of an earlier book, which, again, explores some of these same kinds of issues. That book, The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. He has also written for many periodicals, among them Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Advertising Age. He's also been a columnist for The Guardian and The Industry Standard. And he's joining us by phone. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, certainly you can jump into the conversation. Mr. Carr, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
The kind of questions that you raise, I guess, are not necessarily new. And they have to do with the matter of how it is that that information is delivered. That is how we get it, and how that matters. And that's something that people have, I think, have been thinking about going all the way back to when we started to write things down. But it is also true, I think, at this point, it seems to be more, the pace is more intense, and the concerns about what it's doing to us seem to be more intense now than they have ever been.
I think that's right. I do think we've always, as human beings, we've always known, intuitively at least, that the tools we use to think with, all the whether it's the alphabet or the map or the clock or the book or whatever, do influence not only what we think about, but how we think. And I think there's a long tradition, as you mentioned, of discussions and investigations of that influence. But it certainly seems to be true that, as with most other things involving technology, the speed of the changes in how we get information, how we store information, how we exchange information, is accelerating at a much faster pace than we've ever seen before.
Mm. And that, and maybe one of the problems is that it has happened so fast that it. So your argument is that part of the problems with this technology is that it's maybe eroding our ability to think deeply and carefully about big things. Well, maybe part of the problem here is that it has happened so fast that it hasn't hardly even given us time to think about it. We've just jumped into the pool without standing back and kind of reflecting on the water first.
I think you're right, and it's incredible when you think that, you know, none of us, except those, you know, a few people in academia, had even heard of the Internet 20 years ago, and it was just 20 years ago that the World Wide Web was invented, and it's just within the last 5 or 10 years that the majority of Americans have gained broadband access to the Internet, high-speed access to the Internet. So this, the net, the web, all of our digital media are extraordinarily new phenomena, and yet it testifies to their power and their power over us, I think, that it's almost impossible to imagine how we lived before these things came along, because they're already so deeply entwined, not only in our intellectual life, but in kind of all sorts of practical matters, from shopping to how we get directions and everything. It's hard to think of a media shift or an information technology or communication shift that's happened so quickly and so deeply in society.
And I guess that maybe again is that the one of the things that's really important here is how pervasive and how fast this happened, and one can search for comparisons, but there's never been anything that's probably come on as fast and as strong as this.
I think you can look at radio and television, which came on pretty fast, but didn't have, I don't think it influenced as many aspects of our lives as the Internet has. And you can look back to the printing press, which was invented by Gutenberg around 1450, and in only about 50 years actually spread throughout Europe, which, you know, at the time, this was this is 500 years ago, was an extraordinarily fast explosion of technology, but still, compared to what we're seeing today, seems slow in retrospect.
Yeah, I do find myself thinking about the fact that, though, it seems that when new information technologies come along, that people have always looked at them, some people have looked at them with some suspicion and said, this is going to be a problem. And for example, I think about the fact that at the point where human beings went from largely living in oral cultures to verbal ones, that is, oral traditions moving from oral traditions to written traditions, there were people who said, this is a bad thing, because if we start writing things down, we won't have to remember them anymore, and what will happen is our memories and our ability to remember things will erode.
And it's almost certainly true that they had a point. and Socrates was the most famous person who at least that we know of that enunciated that fear. And he did, you know, he did fear that in moving from a time where our memory was really where we held everything that we knew about the world, and to a time where we'd be able to look things up in books, that we would see an erosion in human memory. And I think that's almost certainly true. I mean, people didn't remember as much after they got books and so forth and scrolls and stuff. On the other hand, you know, I think what Socrates missed, and you know, this is true of all critics of technology, and I think it's probably true of myself as well, is that it's hard to predict, you know, what will be gained when the technology comes along. And so I think ultimately what Socrates and other people who worried about the alphabet and writing and books didn't anticipate was that, in fact, the very act of reading a book would help memory. Because it's such a concentrated, attentive kind of mental process, sitting down with a book. And what actually happened was, and particularly after the invention of the printing presses, a lot of people found that they remembered more, and that their memories became richer as they immersed themselves in the printed word.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Nicholas Carr. He is the author of the book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to make clear here and give you the opportunity to talk about is that you are not, that you are yourself a computer user and a user of the internet. So you're not necessarily saying that what we should do is we should just throw all that stuff away. But at the same time, this, you really started thinking about this because of your own experience with computers and the internet and what you felt, the kind of effect that you felt that was having on you.
Exactly. And, you know, I've always been, I think, much more of a technophile than a technophobe. And, you know, like many people, have enjoyed gadgets and all the things that computers and the internet have brought us. But it was, and I've been a heavy user of all this technology. But a few years ago, I began to realize that I was losing my ability to concentrate, and in particular, my ability to pay attention to one thing for a long period of time. And I noticed it in particular when I'd sit down to try to read a book, something that up until recently has been completely natural part of my life, an important part of my life. And I found that, you know, after a few paragraphs or at most a couple of pages, my mind wanted to behave as it behaved whenever I'd sit in front of a computer. It wanted to start jumping between bits of information, clicking links, doing Googling, checking email. And that really, that personal experience, and I talked to other people, friends and colleagues and so forth, and many of them had noticed similar changes in their ways of thinking. And so it was that experience that launched me into the research that ultimately became this book. Mm-hmm.
And the problem here, as you pointed out, is that the technology makes it really easy to do that, you know, if you read a book, you sit down and you get into that book and you read that book. And I suppose if you wanted to, you could get up and walk across the room, pick up another book and open that up and start looking at that. And then you could go and you pick up another book. But people don't do that. With the computer and with a good connection to the internet, it's really easy to do that, to look at one thing for a little bit and then think you want to look at something else and have that point you to something else. And the argument that you make is that the kind of thinking one does has an effect on the kind of thinking that you want to do or that you are able to do, and that what this is actually doing is that it's rewiring our brains to favor a particular one kind of thinking over another kind of thinking.
Right. In the comparison between a book and a network, internet-connected computer is a very good one, I think, because it's so dramatic. You know, a book shields us from distraction. The only thing going on in the technology itself of the book when we opened it up is the words flowing across the page and page after page of them. And so it encourages us to engage in what is actually a very difficult and unusual and even unnatural mode of thinking, which is a highly attentive mode of thinking. I don't think our earliest ancestors, developed to have this kind of capacity for attentiveness because, you know, your ability to survive at one point in our history probably depended on your ability to shift your attention very, very quickly and pay attention to everything that was going on in the environment rather than focus on one thing. The Internet, it seems to me, returns us more to that very primitive but also very natural style of thinking. Its fundamental quality as a technology, I think, is to inundate us with interruptions. In fact, that's why we value it, because it allows us to jump quickly between different bits of information. We have lots of things going on simultaneously. We have lots of messages coming through at us. And so it, unlike the book, it encourages this very distracted, very fast-paced, very juggling, skimming, scanning mode of thinking. And I think one thing we know about the brain is it gets better at the things we do a lot with it, the things we do repetitively, and it begins to lose the functions that we don't practice, that we don't exercise. So the emphasis that different technologies place on different modes of thinking really affects not only our habits, but is wired deeply into kind of our neural circuits over time.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting notion, that is a particular kind of thinking, that is the kind of thinking that goes along with a task, like reading a book, like sitting down and concentrating on one thing, is not natural to us. It was something that we had to learn, and it's the kind of thing that grows, your ability to do that grows with practice, and that perhaps the less you do that, it's like, you know, the muscle that wastes away if you don't use it. That is, the less you do it, or you do a different kind of thinking, maybe the kind that's more natural, then the other ability is something that you might well lose because you don't do it.
Right, and neuroscientists, and this ability of the brain to adapt, even the adult brain to adapt fairly readily to habits and to circumstances, is something that's only really been discovered by neuroscientists and psychologists over the last 30 or 40 years. It used to be assumed that, you know, the circuits, the brain circuits that we wired during our childhood were the ones we were stuck with throughout our adult lives. But in fact, our brains are always adapting down at the cellular level to what we use them for. And neuroscientists even have a kind of phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together, to describe this. So if you repeatedly practice certain modes of thought, those modes get wired into the circuitry of your brain at ever more kind of stronger and distinctively. And those you neglect, on the other hand, begin to weaken. So these shifts in thinking that are encouraged by the different technologies we use do have, I think, echoes in the actual biology of our brain.
And that is something that we have more than anecdotal evidence for?
Yes. I mean, we have more than anecdotal evidence for what scientists call neuroplasticity. There's a whole, you know, in the last 40 years, there have been huge numbers of studies that show our brains adapting, you know, and in some cases they're adapting when we suffer brain injuries. Our brains are very flexible in shifting different processing to different cellular areas. But also there have been lots of experiments involving tool usage and how our brains adapt to the tools we use. So there's a huge amount of evidence that the brain is very adaptable. There haven't been that many studies of actual brain cells and brain activities in response to the Internet, because the Internet is so new and because it's kind of hard to replicate Internet surfing in a brain scanning machine.
Yeah,
but there have been lots of studies of aspects of the Internet as a medium in how it influences our comprehension and thinking and so forth.
Well, that's sort of what I was thinking about. I think what you say is true, and maybe also as we age is encouraging, the idea that, yes, people's brains do change over the course of the life, it is possible for you to learn new things. And, you know, it's not set in concrete when you're 2 years old. I was more thinking about, you know, the idea that this is your brain on the internet, and whether, in fact, that someone has actually been able to actually look at what was going on and say that that there's some sort of concrete evidence for what it is you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, there's been at least one fairly extensive study of changes in brain activity as we get used to surfing the web, or more particularly as we get used to searching the web. And that was done at UCLA a couple of years ago. And basically what the researchers found was that it took only a fairly small amount of practice in using the web for people's brains to display quite different patterns of brain activity, quite different, you know, different parts of their brains engaging with web surfing, which implies that, you know, the web can have a fairly strong and fairly quick influence on brain activity. Now, that seems to be, it's as with all kind of brain scan studies, it's somewhat ambiguous, and it's hard to interpret simply because you're seeing where there's activity, but you're not seeing anything about the quality of thought. But there seems to be, you know, it seems to be a two-edged sword, at least that experiment shows, that on the one hand, when we use the web, a lot of decision-making parts, problem-solving parts of our brain are activated, which makes sense because you have to figure out, you know, do I want to click on this link? Do I want to go to this search result or that one? On the other hand, there seems to be a tension between having lots of decision making and problem solving going on in your brain and your ability to actually read deeply or think attentively about one thing. In many cases, when we read a traditional book, for instance, a lot of the decision making and problem solving parts of the brain actually show quite muted activity, and so that indicates a deep attentiveness, that we're not being distracted. So that one study indicates, yes, the brain does change in response to web use, and there are some things that are gained. We're exercising our decision-making parts of our brain, but there are probably things being lost, which is our ability to pay deep attention to something. And that fits with earlier psychological studies, not brain scan studies, but psychological studies of how things like hypertext and multimedia and multitasking and interruptions tend to undermine comprehension and understanding and learning.
All right, let's talk with someone here and bring them into the conversation. The caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Interesting discussion. When you mentioned the word thought, it occurred to me that, of course, this is the reiteration of the mind-body paradox in some ways, isn't it? And my thought, or my observation, or what I'd like you to remark on, if you won't you care to, is the fact that given evolution, human evolution took, well, you know, 6 million years or whatever you want to call it, whatever happens now in the last 50, isn't that sort of an aberration? And it really only happens to a small percentage of the world's population. Are we sort of weighing this too heavily? I'll just listen. Thank you.
All right.
I think the caller is absolutely right in drawing a distinction between evolutionary change, which happens at a very, by human standards, very, very slowly. And I don't think what we're seeing as we use different technologies is the kind of genetic changes we see with evolution. But I think what we know is that one of the things that evolution has given us is a great deal of mental adaptability. And so we can, without having genetic changes, we can have strong and distinct changes in the ways that we think. And I think we saw that, and I talk about this in the book, you know, going back to the arrival of the map and the clock, and I certainly think we saw it with the arrival of the book, and in particular the printed book, and I think we're seeing it as well and quite strongly with the arrival of the internet. So these aren't genetic changes to the brain, but these are quite extensive biological changes, cellular changes, nonetheless, which our genetic makeup has enabled us to have in our minds.
Well, that I think gets to a what seems to me a really interesting and not easy question, and that is, it has to do with the relationship between humans and their tools, and the fact that technology has always been a factor in human evolution, and that that just kind of is, and we might lament that fact, and we might question it, and we might want to ask questions about, well, should, you know, do we want to use technologies or not? But there, it seems that there's almost a certain inevitability about this.
I certainly don't disagree with that. I mean, I do think that in many ways the internet is part of a long story, a 100-year story about modern media, electric and then electronic media. And I think there are many aspects of the web that that fit into the story of the general story of electric media, mass media, and their influence on the way we think. And one important part of that story is that these media tend to be, and they tend to progress in a way that emphasizes taking in small bits of information very quickly, and that de-emphasizes attentive, concentrated, focused thinking. What they tend to be to do, and I think the internet is greatly amplifying this, is encourage us to skim and to scan and to browse and to juggle information, but discourage us from engaging in contemplation, reflection, introspection, deep reading, the kind of solitary, attentive modes of thought. And so, you know, even if this is in some ways a long-term progression of technology, I think it's very important to be able to step back and say and question what's going on, you know, and look at not only the benefits we gain from having access to so much information so quickly, but also, you know, isn't it important, aren't the things that we are losing and sacrificing, aren't they also important to our intellectual lives, to the richness of our personalities and ourselves, and to the richness of culture? Mm.
Well, I suppose it really does get you thinking about what it means to be informed. And could make the argument that with a technology like this, it is a tool so that you could deeply learn about something. The problem seems to be that most people don't use it that way, and that what they may know a little bit about a lot of things, but that it's a mile wide and a millimeter deep, and that is a problem too. That we're the way we use it and what we start to think constitutes knowing something.
And the reason it encourages us to think in that way, the mile wide, inch deep way, is in some deep way, in deep sense, that's the way our brains actually want to behave. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of psychological studies that show that human beings crave new information. And so if you give us access to a machine that's constantly pumping out new information, we'll keep going back and getting new stuff. And it doesn't matter even, and this is the scary thing, whether that new information is trivial or important. We simply will find it almost compulsive to go back and get it, and we will stop thinking about something that is important and that really warrants deep thought if we have a sense that we can go out and get, you know, the latest tweet or the latest instant message or the latest email. So this is, you know, the reason this is having such deep effects is because it does appeal to some primitive, basic mental instinct that we have.
And that I do think, and I know that it's something people worry about, is that when you that you argue that we have developed this craving, and it's not just a craving for all of this information, that it has to also to do with immediacy. That it seems that the focus of everything is now. It's what's happening now, and it seems that what's happened is that we get stuck in a constant present, and that may not necessarily be the best sort of frame of mind to be in.
One of the basic problems with that mode is that it creates what brain scientists call cognitive overload, that we're taking in so much new information so quickly that we overwhelm the capacity of our short-term or working memory. And that's the part of our memory that holds things very briefly and in the moment of consciousness, and only has a very small capacity. And if your short-term, your working memory is overloaded, information doesn't make the transition into long-term memory. And it's only when information and experiences and facts and so forth get into long-term memory that they begin to be woven together. And that's where it's long-term memory that is the seat of conceptual understanding, the seat of critical thinking and so forth. So the problem here, goes beyond just snacking on information. It's that the more we do that, the more we try to take in lots of little bits of information very quickly, the less, we're activating those parts of our brain that really do the deep, rich, distinctive, creative types of thinking that I think ultimately, are crucial to the depth of our the depth of our intellectual lives and our mm-hmm. mental functions. So there is a very strong trade-off here, and we are losing something. Even as we gain the ability to grab all this information quickly.
Well, and that takes me back to Socrates and his concern about writing things down. You start thinking, yeah, maybe Socrates was right, and he didn't even know the half of it.
Well, in the book, I argue that maybe Socrates was right, but he had the wrong target. It wasn't the book he should have, or the alphabet he should have been worried about. It was maybe the web, which does seem to be a technology of forgetfulness. We begin to think that since everything's out there and we can Google it up in a second, maybe we don't need to remember anything anymore. And that you even see that in kind of popular conversation in popular culture that we can outsource our brain to the internet. We can outsource our memory to the internet. We don't have to use it anymore. And that's a very dangerous notion because our memory really is where all the interesting things in our minds happen, where we get those internal personal connections that you don't get when you just go out and Google stuff off the net.
Well, I guess I still though find myself thinking of it, going back to whenever it was that in that classroom, whenever it was when the student says to the teacher, "Why do I need to memorize? Why do I need to remember the date of the French Revolution? I can go over to this book and I can look it up." Well, now we say, "Well, why do I need to remember the French Revolution? I can go to Wikipedia and I can look it up." Are those two really so different?
Well, I think if we looked at the web as a supplement to memory, which is how we've always looked at books, say, and mm-hmm. other information storage technologies, maps, and so forth, then I think that would be the appropriate way to think of the technology. Because we do want, obviously, what we gained when we went from an oral culture to a written culture was this expansion of information that we had access to, and it wasn't just what was inside our own memory. The danger is when we begin to look at an external technology not as a supplement to our biological memory, but as a replacement. And there's this common idea that you see enunciated sometimes that if we don't have to remember stuff, then we free up our brain for deeper thoughts, which is actually precisely the opposite of what we know about the brain. In fact, the more we hold in our personal memory, the more easily we find it to learn new information in the deeper our thinking. It's important to have this supplement out there to memory, but it's also critically important to actually remember stuff, to entrust lots of experiences and lots of information, even lots of facts, to our long-term memory. We shouldn't be cavalier about thinking that our biological memory is like a hard drive, which it is not, and And hence, it doesn't matter if the stuff is out on the web or inside our skull. There's a big difference between those two things. Mm.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus, Nicholas Carr. He's the author of the book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and is published by W.W. Norton. It's just recently out. He is someone who's made a specialty of writing about social, economic, and business implications of technology. He's the author of an earlier book, The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google, and he's written for a number of publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times Magazine, Wired, Advertising Age. He's also been a columnist for The Guardian and The Industry Standard, and wrote an article that was published in The Atlantic Monthly back in the summer of 2008 that got a lot of people thinking and talking. The title of that essay is Google Making Us Stupid, and the book The Shallows takes some of those ideas and further develops them in a bigger way. And if you're interested, you'd head out to the bookstore and take a look at it. Questions, too, are welcome here on the show. Call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you would be making a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll talk with someone else here on our toll-free line. Line 4, hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Now, I've looked at a very limited view of things, okay? So I've looked at a small sample of this. But it seems to me that the Internet, in some ways, is very much like the telephone. And follow my analogy here, if you can. There are people who just cannot reach over and pick up a phone that's ringing. And then there are people who can ignore it. And I think the Internet is very much the same way, that you have so many people sending information to you, and so people just get stuck on getting all the information. Then there are other people who can just say, well, you know, I really don't need that in my life, and wander on. And people can forget about the aspect that a lot of people do that. Forget the Internet, I'm saying. Just not give that as part of their problem.
Yeah, I think, I think that's absolutely true, and a good point that, you know, we are not all the same. We don't all have the same minds, thank goodness, and we don't all have the same habits. And there are certainly some people who can use the net in a very attentive way and shield out just the distractions that pour through their screen and, you know, only check email once a day or twice a day or whatever. And I think it's important to make that acknowledgement. On the other hand, I do think that is not the mode of behavior and the mode of mental behavior in particular that the net as a technology encourages. And I think if you look more broadly across society and across Internet users in general, you see that the net, and I've certainly felt this in my own life, promotes that skimming and scanning and multitasking behavior because that's the That's the nature of the technology itself. So I think we need to both acknowledge the fact that different people will use different technologies in different ways, but also to acknowledge the fact that technologies, information technologies, do tend to emphasize some modes of thinking and de-emphasize other modes of thinking.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks. I'm just curious, Mr. Carr, do you have children?
I do.
You
yeah.
do, and I would assume that their approach to all of this is much different than yours, or do they say, oh, Dad, you're getting all upset about it, and it's not that bad, and you don't need to worry about that, and why would we want to turn it off?
Well, they're in their early 20s, so they didn't grow up, with perpetual text messaging and Facebook and so forth. And so I think their attitude toward technology is different than mine. They certainly do a heck of a lot more texting than I do. But I don't think I think they still value and still try to seek out more attentive ways of thinking and realize that the net, there are times maybe when it's better off to turn these things off than to keep them on all the time. At least I hope they realize that.
Well, I guess I'm just thinking about how generational differences when it comes to this technology, how dramatic they are, and how for someone of the generation of the caller or mine, for example, I'll use myself, that it might be easier for us to say we can turn it off, or I don't really need this in my life, or might be think more about how it might come to dominate your life, and that it compared that with somebody who was younger, the people who are the digital natives. I like that term a lot. Now, as opposed to digital immigrants like me, that people of that generation who were so much immersed in this technology, when they hear this conversation about the, you know, maybe it'd be good to turn it off, would be the ones who would be more likely to say, well, why would you want to? What do you mean, turn it off? Why? It's great. You know, they don't quite seem to have the same sort of questions and concerns that we would.
I think that's true to an extent. I'm not as big a fan of the term digital native as you are, because it implies that the mental effects are different on the young than they are on older adults, and I don't think that's true. I think you can get used to the technology, and you can, you know, feel that processing, you know, little messages every minute of the day is somehow natural in the usual state of things. But that doesn't mean that you're not still suffering the same cognitive sacrifices as anyone else suffers, because there are some basic aspects to the brain, such as the capacity of our short-term memory, that simply don't change. It doesn't matter how often you engage in this behavior. So I think it's absolutely true that, you know, growing up in this environment gives you a different relationship to it, and it makes it seem more normal and more natural. But that doesn't mean you're not suffering the same kind of losses that other people are suffering. Yeah.
Well, I take your point, and I see that is an important distinction. And I guess I was mostly thinking about it simply in terms of the idea that there's a the way you relate to this kind of technology may. It's certainly going to be shaped by whether you were born into a world where it was always there, or you were born into a world where for 50 years it wasn't, and that's definitely going to have an effect on how you think about it and how you use it and how readily you adapt to it. But I certainly take I certainly take the point that you are making about the effect that it has, it doesn't matter whether you were born into that world or not.
Right. And I think, and I think you're absolutely right. But I think it's also important to realize that it's only really been in the last 5 years, I think, that children have begun to be kind of immersed in this world. Because up until recently, if you looked at web statistics, you'd see that people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s used the web much more frequently than, say, teenagers, and certainly more than younger children did. But in the last 5 years, we've seen the explosion of social messaging systems, Facebook, text messaging, Twitter, and suddenly, you know, and you can see this by watching pretty much any kid who has a cell phone, this kind of the state of being constantly inundated with digital messages has really become central to the lives of ever younger children. And I think you need to be worried about what the long-term consequences for intellectual development are. If what we're saying to kids as parents is it's okay to be interrupted every couple of minutes throughout every waking hour you have, when do these kids learn to pay attention? Or will they learn to pay attention? So I think in just the last few years, we've seen a big shift in the kind of consequences or the power of the technology over the very young.
Another call here. Let's talk with them on our line one. Hello.
Yes. I'm involved in helping develop schools in Ghana, Africa, and we have about 1,200 students. And my Ghanaian partner, we do have a few computers. He would like to get more, and as you probably know, there is a Harvard professor who has the one laptop, one child, one laptop company. Do you think that it's important to have computers in a situation like that?
I think that having computer skills is going to be something that kids need to learn, and that's particularly true of less developed countries, of poorer kids, because you're increasingly your career opportunities, your economic opportunities hinge on your ability to be comfortable using a computer and to have access to a computer and to the internet. So I certainly don't think that, you know, anything I say should lead us to, you know, rush to pull computers out of schools entirely. On the other hand, I do think that as educators and as parents, we tend to get too enthusiastic about technology's role in improving education, despite the fact that there are now quite a few studies that show that, you know, simply giving a kid a computer or access to the internet does not improve their educational performance, and in some cases, at least in developed countries, can reduce their academic performance, because basically, even though we think kids are going to be using these things for studying and for intellectual endeavors, what they're really using them for is for entertainment and for interruptions and for communication. So even as we think about investing in the developing world, we should certainly, you know, be aware of the benefits that computers and other technologies can bring, but we shouldn't underestimate the importance of investing in teachers and in books and in, you know, physical classrooms. In the end, those things may be more important than how many computers we can shove at kids.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. We do have just about 5 minutes, though. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me ask you to respond to one of the kind of criticisms that has been made of the book. And there are some people who would say, well, you know, you can look back, pick any time that you like. How many people were really engaged in really deep thinking? And, you know, say, let's take the year I was born. Let's take 1953. Were we really any smarter then? Are we really more stupid now? Are we worrying about something that's not really a problem?
I think it is a problem, and I would point, and I think I've seen a lot of people underestimate the centrality of the printed page to culture, not only in the 1950s or 1960s, but going back for hundreds of years. And I think that technology did encourage deeper thought and more attentive thought. But even beyond that, I'm sure it's true that only a small percentage of a fairly small percentage of the population has probably engaged in really deep, creative, distinctive thinking. But even granting that's true, that doesn't make that mode of thinking more dispensable. It makes it more precious. And we should be doing whatever we can to make sure that those people are trained in those methods of thinking. And if we're pushing even those people to be superficial thinkers and to be skimmers and scanners and browsers, then that's even a greater cause for concern and possibly a greater, you know, social and cultural tragedy than if those skills were commonplace.
Mm. I'm sure that there are people who would agree with your argument, but then would say that to try to change this or to challenge it, it's you know, it's like stepping out in front of the proverbial snowball rolling down the hill. You can hold up your hand and say stop, but you're going to get rolled over. That it's not an easy thing to challenge or to turn around. So I suppose that the question is, well, assuming that we agree with you and we think that it has all these problems, what do you do about that?
I think there are big social forces and technological forces that are pushing us as a society away from deeply attentive thinking and toward the modes of thinking that the internet encourages. And I think the expectation of being constantly connected is starting to be built deeply into our work lives, and it's now being built into our social lives, where everybody, particularly the young, are arranging their social lives through Facebook and text messaging and so forth. So it may well be that we're on this path, and there's nothing that's going to push us out of it. On the other hand, as individuals, we still have choices to make about how we focus or fail to focus our minds. And so I think as individuals, we should question our use of this technology, particularly the intensive use of it. And if we value the more contemplative modes of thought, then really we need to make the sacrifices necessary to engage in them, to turn off our gadgets and sit down and read deeply or think deeply or to listen to a long piece of music or whatever, because if you don't exercise those ways of thinking as an individual, you're probably going to lose them.
And we started out talking about the fact that at one point you began thinking about this because you, and as I said, and you said, well, yes, you use computers, you use the internet, but that a point came when you thought for yourself you had lost the ability to concentrate and that maybe your pattern of internet use had something to do with that. As a result of having gone through all this and thinking about it, were there some changes that you instituted in your own life to address these concerns?
I did, and particularly in order to write the book. I backed away from the net to a degree. I reduced the number of times I check email. I dropped off of Facebook and dropped out of Twitter. And most important of all, I think I changed the way I used the web. So I continued to use it, search engines and so forth, to discover relevant information. Books and journal articles, for instance, that had relevance to my book and my research. But then I made the effort to actually go to a library and get the printed book or get the printed journal and sit down and read these things in print. And I found that did make a big difference to my habits of mind. I did start to regain some of the powers of concentration and attentiveness that I felt I'd been losing. Now, unfortunately, more recently, since I've finished the book and it's come out, and I found myself kind of backsliding and checking email much more frequently and going online much more frequently. So it is hard today to back away from the technology. But I do think, and again, this is from my personal experience, I do think that making the effort to do that does have fairly quickly and fairly dramatically effects on our thought processes.
And it's going to, the bottom line, I guess, for you is that it's actually something that is going to have to be a deliberate effort. That is, you're going to have to make a point of doing that.
I think it's always been hard for people to pay attention, and it's always required a deliberate effort. And today, it's harder than ever because of the technologies we use. And so, yeah, it's not something that's just going to happen unless you really want to make it happen.
A lot of interesting things here and things to think about. The book is The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. It's published by W.W. Norton by our guest Nicholas Carr. And Mr. Carr, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting is from 2 to 6 p.m. and features a lineup that includes a mix of old world and new wines, all from France. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, September wheat trading at 670.5, up 24.25. December 687.5, up 24.5. 687.75, latest tick. In Chicago, September wheat 654, up 26.5. December 686, up 26.5. September corn 389, up 9 3/4. December, 403, up 9 1/2. March, 415 1/4, up 8 3/4. May, 423, up 9. August beans, 1044 1/2, up 17 3/4. September, 1005 3/4, up 13. November, 999 1/4, up 11 1/4. January, 1005 3/4, up 10 1/4. August meal, 308.70, that's up 3.